Observatory, straight at the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
I basically just think it would be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing, in rap especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
This looks like, it's a nightclub in the 80s, actually. This feels like Studio 54. Where are we going?
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Tina Brown, my friend and predecessor at the New Yorker, is a legend in magazine publishing and a force of nature in the very best way.
Hello. I'm just saying this looks like a Schrager Hotel around here. I mean, where's my lunch reservation? Hello, how are you?
It's Tina Brown.
Brown came to the United States in 1983 to take over Vanity Fair magazine. She'd been running the small but influential British magazine, gossipy thing called Tatler. And very quickly, at Vanity Fair, she somehow caught the American zeitgeist of the 80s. She mixed glamour and celebrities and glossy photography with serious reporting and intellectual heft in a winning formula that made Vanity Fair a must-read. Later, Brown went on to edit The New Yorker and Talk, and she founded The Daily Beast. Tina Brown has just published a chronicle of her first years in the United States, and it's called The Vanity Fair Diaries. She was not even 30 years old when the adventure starts. You weren't happy immediately. You arrive in New York on April 10th, 1983, and you say that your London bravado almost immediately began to evaporate. What was your sense of the city, and why did your bravado, which I've never known to evaporate?
I was absolutely mowed down by the velocity of New York. I mean, I realized
this
suddenly—
This is 80s Reagan—
80s Reagan New York. I arrived for my job interview just before Christmas when the stores are just sort of alight with, materialistic, thrumming commerce, and Christmas lights and holiday blah, blah, blah coming at me, Then I take over and just the velocity of the sort of American media machines just seemed to me so big. Condé Nast felt like General Motors to me.
How so?
Because it was a corporation with an HR department and an editorial director and people dealing with my visa and another person dealing with my papers and another person who was called in to design my office. And there seemed to be all these departments and layers and all of these amazing things. And also the media landscape was so unfamiliar to me. There were all of these huge magazines which all seemed to have so much budget. I mean, the budget for the Tatler was £100,000 a year.
What was your budget for Vanity Fair?
I didn't have a budget for Vanity Fair. I mean, that was what's so amazing, is when I came in, I said to Alexander Lieberman, the great editorial director, what's my budget? And he said, my dear, first things first, do what you need to do, and then we'll discuss the budget.
And that nobody would ever reward you if you lost money. In other words, the thing to do was create something great. This was a very different era.
It was a very different era. I mean, look, they also, of course, I did have a budget later on, but their attitude was, we've got to fix this thing. They'd spent a fortune. I mean, they'd spent like, I think, $30 million or $40 million even before I got through the door. I mean, just gone Venezuela. I mean, there was nothing to show for it, right? Except, bad reviews. So they recognized that they were in crisis mode. And then in that sense, actually, what I did love about Condé Nast was it really was an ethos of like, okay, it's failed. It's screwed up. No blame here. Let's just like get on with it. Let's just fix it. What do you need? What do you need?
What was an ideal issue of Vanity Fair, and how did it reflect the times? I mean, I remember William Shawn, the great editor of the New Yorker, many years ago, used to carry around in his wallet an ideal issue of the New Yorker, like a kid dreaming up an ideal baseball team. What was an ideal issue of Vanity Fair, your favorite issue of it, and why?
It would have a strong, fabulous narrative yarn, a really top-class yarn that was the zeitgeist yarn. I mean, today, the zeitgeist yarn would have been, the Harvey Weinstein story or, Trump, in Asia or whatever. But it has to have that big, juicy, juicy yarn. It has to have a wonderful celebrity cover that has a lot of appeal.
That sells the magazine.
That sells the magazine, that is glamorous and stylish and, atop an A-list face. Then we might have something that was what I call how we live today. You know, we had a wonderful piece called Acceleration Syndrome about how fast life had got with all the fax machines and all the modem.
Fax machines.
And you know what? Phones in cars, David.
Do
it
tell.
Really did, you know, up the pace. I look at it now and I just roll about laughing about, you know, this piece about, you know, it was talked about particle people and how the world had become so fast because of all of these things that they all had. Little did we know what was about to happen to us all. But that kind of piece, the life. So, and then that would really be those four or five things. And then you would be able to drop in what I call, you know, a kind of an esprit, something that was then another piece that was like a PS. It could be a fun piece by Christopher Buckley or an amusing feuilleton.
You're working on the magazine all day long, but you're also living another life at night. And you decided to live your life in a certain way. I couldn't do it in a million years, but you did it and you found stories in it. It
seemed all the time.
The book is filled with hilarious evenings at Alice Mason's dinner table and, you know, this grandee's dinner table. Are you going because it's fun? Are you going as a journalist? There's an ambivalence in the book about this way of living life and its effect on Vanity Fair.
Well, there's always an ambivalence in me about going out at all. I mean, my instinct is to dive under my duvet and watch Netflix. You know, I don't want to go anywhere. But I always find I get a story when I go out. And Vanity Fair was a magazine about and for the zeitgeist. I mean, it needed to have its fingers on the pulse of the
time. And a particular zeitgeist.
A particular zeitgeist. The zeitgeist of glossy. You know, the zeitgeist of power, of money, of what makes the wheels of society go around. Therefore, for me to go out at night, I got leads, I got stories, I got observations, I got contacts, stuff I would feed to the writers. And a lot of it also, I have to admit, was sort of observation greed. You know, I'm a natural reporter. I want to report. And, I mean, now I look back on that era, it was just insane. I mean, I don't know when I slept, and I don't even possess.
Did you sleep?
Very rarely. I mean, I don't even possess a long dress now. I think I've got one long skirt, right? I was like up there dressed to the nines. I mean, I had scarlet nail polish and I had, you know, glittering gowns and I was out there, you know, hitting those black. People had black tie sit-down dinners in their own apartments. I had a black tie dinner in my apartment. I mean, it's insane.
So you're going out at night, you're working your head off during the day, but at one point in the diary you complain or say that it's pretty hairy when the best stories right now are attached to people I socialize with. Give me an example. Give me an example of where friendship clashed with journalism.
There were many times when it happened, but perhaps one of the most uncomfortable times was when I assigned a review of Sally Quinn's novel Regrets Only to Christopher Buckley, who I thought, well, that's a great mix. I mean, here's Buckley, who knows the social world, here's Quinn, and he knows Washington. It'll be really fun, and this is a lively social eye on Washington. Buckley's the guy to do it. Okay, well, he wrote a piece that just called the book Clitrature, right? And it went on from there.
And you were married in the garden of Sally Quinn.
Indeed. Sally Quinn and Ben Bradley were two very, very good friends. We had married in Grey Gardens.
She didn't appreciate literature?
Well, we were just, let's just say that this was the week before Ben's annual birthday party at Grey Gardens in August. And I get a telegram from Sally Quinn.
A telegram.
A telegram, as we...
That's dramatic.
A telegram, which is what used to happen in those days, disinviting me from the annual Grey Gardens fiesta. And I was sort of stunned by it and deeply sort of not really knowing what I should have done. I'd concluded that what I should have done and what I then did always was give her an early heads up. I should have sent her the magazine before anybody else saw it so that, you know, you have to prepare the ha 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 as if I care quote. You don't want to be caught sort of red-faced and sweating when at the same time the magazine arrives. So I learned from that not to do that.
There are so many figures that waltz through the pages of this diary that are memorable, but the one that you have to read now in retrospect as even more memorable is Donald Trump, who was a clown figure in those days. You went to any number of social occasions where he was there. How did he look to you then, and in retrospect, did you have any idea that this could possibly happen?
Well, I first encountered him actually at a dinner that Ann Getty, the socialite from San Francisco, hosted, I think it was. And, you know, he'd just published The Art of the Deal, and I'd actually extracted it in Vanity Fair. And he was sitting sort of...
Why?
Because I thought this is authentic bullshit. That's what I thought, if there is such a thing. You know, this is, there's something beguiling about this voice. I mean, you know, it was like he was, you know, the creature of Trump Tower. He seemed to represent and epitomize the whole brassy craziness of the time. And here was this book that was just like being buttonholed by this utterly, you know, this con man. But it was fun to listen to. So I liked the book in that sense. I thought it was authentic. And many a person has heard that latterly from about Donald Trump. And you know, we might think differently now, but it felt that it was the real thing about being not the real thing, if you know what I mean. So he was sitting next to me two doors down at this dinner, and each of our dinner partners was ignoring us. So we ended up sort of talking over our dinner partners.
What was the conversation like?
Well, he was just like, you know, Tina, you know, like went to the opera last night. 2.5 hours before I even got a break. I mean, I said to Ivana, never again, never again. Pavarotti, who? So it was like that, you know. And I was amused. I thought, you know, he's saying exactly what I would think. And I had this fussy sort of Italian decorator the other side who I just wanted to shut up. And Trump was bouncing it back and forth. And it was all about him. It was like, what do you think about me on the cover of Newsweek? You know, what's better, Newsweek or Time? They wanted me too. I said, well, Newsweek. I said, well, Time's better, actually. Oh, well, no, it's not. It doesn't sell as much. It was all about him and covers. And of course, we now know that's him, right? But then he got very annoyed with us because, of course, we then really began to cover him. And Marie Brenner did one of the first of the really good pieces about him, which talked about him as a bankrupt, about how he was a complete fraud in business, how he was, how he couldn't get a loan anywhere, and how he was in the middle of this ugly divorce, you know, with Ivana. So he then turned, obviously, against us. And he was so angry with Marie that about 6 months later at a dinner party, a dinner at a benefit, that she went to after a Barbara Streisand movie. She was sitting having dinner in her black tie table, and she suddenly feels something wet on her back, and she looks around and she sees the waiter and she thinks maybe he spilled a drink. Then she sees Donald Trump with a sneaky expression on his face, like aiming off the other end of the room, sort of holding a drink, and realized that he'd poured wine all down her back and then split. So that was who Donald Trump was then, and you could argue what who Donald Trump is now.
I think you could easily argue that now. You were thinking about, at one point, writing about Hillary Clinton, and I wonder how you view her now.
Well, I mean, Hillary Clinton seems to have become the sort of walking paradigm of what happens to women when they try and compete in a way. It does seem like the most grotesque irony that the most qualified person in, you know, you could possibly imagine for the job loses out to the guy who comes in with the swinging, shall we say, self-confidence and walks into it with a big load of blarney, you know.
What does it tell you?
Well, it's what happens to women a great deal. That's what it tells you. That's the irony.
Do you think that's happened to you ever at any point?
I think that what I learned in my career is that a woman has to be gold for a silver situation, if you know what I'm saying.
I do.
That women have to just be so much better to be considered and work so much harder to be considered and find it so much more difficult to convince the powers that be that they're worth backing, that they're worth financing, that they're worth, giving a try to, which is why women so often end up in the jobs when they're not worth having. I mean, look at network news anchors. I mean, women only got network news when nobody was watching it anymore, right? Look at, you know, General Motors. Mary Barra comes in when there's been a recall, when the company's in a complete disaster. Then they're going to give Mary Barra a try. And guess what? She did brilliantly in the job. So there is a sense of kind of broken things that women in the end, when they've tried everything, they bring in the woman.
Did you feel that way about The New Yorker?
I certainly was aware that it wasn't an accident that I get to come in when things are going wrong. Whether I would have been given the job if things had been going right, I don't know. I never felt actual sexism in my career. You know, I was too busy storming ahead.
You haven't?
Not in the sense it thwarted me. You know, I was too busy blazing ahead. But as I went on in my career, I began to understand certain things that I had just blazed past, you know, because I was just focused.
Like what?
A sense that my input, for instance, into the business direction of both Vanity Fair and The New Yorker was never, ever listened to. You know, that's women will often tell you they don't feel heard. And it's frustrating.
And I have to ask this. You left The New Yorker in 1998. Believe me,
yes.
I remember, Tina.
Indeed.
And you went to do Talk Magazine in partnership with Harvey Weinstein, who's
indeed.
Who's
let's how just, great does that career decision look in retrospect?
Well, and the news has even gone beyond that in recent weeks about Harvey Weinstein. When you look back at that and his behavior, what did you see? What did you not see?
Well, I did see a man who, in business, mirrored very much what was happening in private, but I just didn't see the private stuff. I was more consumed about the business stuff. I mean, he was a volcanic, you know, bullying, duplicitous guy. I bitterly regretted going to work with him pretty much immediately because of that profanity and erraticness of his.
Was he threatening?
He could be very intimidating, yes, if he didn't get his own way. Very, very intimidating. And, you know, he was often wrong. Having said that, I went to work with him because his work had been, up to that point, extremely good. You know, what I saw was The English Patient and Shakespeare in Love and My Left Foot and My Beautiful Laundrette. Pretty much every movie that I'd loved had been produced by Miramax.
He had good taste.
He had wonderful taste. And I thought, okay, Rough Diamond, you know, I grew up, my father was in show business. I'm used to the Rough Diamond film producer. I thought that's what he was. Rough Diamond film producer, bonhomous, you know, generous, bonhomous, vulgar, but with great taste. Boy, was I wrong about that.
And when you learn about what he was all about, how common do you think this is, and how does it make you think about the workplace? Right now, you're running a terrific enterprise called Women in the World. This is discussed from stages all over the world from your program. What do men not know?
I think men are genuinely reexamining how they carry on. I mean, in fairness, I do think it's very important that we distinguish between the rapists, you know, and the assaulters and the clueless fumblers, you know, and the, you know, tactless remarkers and all the other bastion of men who are now being somewhat cast into the same basket. I mean, I don't think you should be put into a murderer's row for having, you know, put your hand on somebody's knee in 1985. That concerns me because I don't want to feel that we are really unfairly...
You're concerned that the process is going to go too far?
It could go too far. But at the same time, I'm very happy the watershed has happened because I think women are really have put up with a tremendous amount and not spoken about it. I mean, one of the things that's so difficult right now is that just when you think that you know the limit of somebody's predations, suddenly another huge shoe drops. I mean, I have friends who've been accused of things who I want, in a sense, instinctively to defend, but I have held back because I don't know what's coming next. You know, I don't know what's coming next. And the truth is, you realize that you don't really know anybody, you know?
Tina Brown, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Tina Brown, editor extraordinaire formerly of Vanity Fair, The Daily Beast, and The New Yorker. Her new book is The Vanity Fair Diaries 1983 to 1992. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and thanks for joining me today at the New Yorker Radio Hour. Jenny Allen is a writer and a performer, and she's got a few things she'd like to say. Or more to the point, a few things she'd like you not to say.
Would everybody please stop? Would everybody please stop saying iteration? Who started iteration? Isn't it just a stuck-up version of version? Not everything is surreal. Some things are merely strange or odd or some other similar adjective. Going to your college reunion and seeing how old everyone looks isn't surreal. It's just kind of sad and a little funny. You know what's not funny anymore? Ginormous. It would be great if everyone would stop saying that. Unless you're talking about, say, cancer, would everyone please stop referring to the toxins in people's bodies? A malignant tumor is a toxin. The bacteria lining your intestines are not. They're supposed to be there. Similarly, could people stop calling other people toxic? Pol Pot was toxic, but your cranky mailman isn't. He's just annoying. Could we lose have a good one and go back to have a good day? Or better, goodbye? Regarding it's all good. Not all of it is good. Some of it is tragic. As for sad events, let us quit saying, get over it. It's too mean. We're trying to get over it. Deplane is a word that the airline industry made up, like jetway, to make airplane travel sound efficient and glamorous. Unless we're flight attendants, we don't have to use that word. Better to say, after we sat on the runway for 2 fucking hours, they canceled the flight for no fucking reason, and we all had to get off the fucking plane. Thank you so much for cooperating. Goodbye.
That's the writer and performer Jenny Allen reading, Would Everyone Please Stop? It's the title piece in her new collection, and you can find everything she's written for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. We're going to wrap things up this week by getting out of the office for a little bit, which will be a relief. If you go for a walk on the west side of Manhattan, a little past Times Square, you might come upon a big pink pig on the sidewalk. He or she, it's kind of ambiguous, is standing on hind legs and beckoning us to come into Rudy's Bar. In a neighborhood that's changed a lot, Rudy's has been a touchstone since Prohibition ended. It's not far from where our offices used to be. And for New Yorker cartoonist Emily Flake, Rudy's is a kind of home away from home.
This is one of a few bars in the city that that I enjoy coming to. Not as often as I used to, because I'm old now and I have a kid. But it's one of a certain kind of bar. I suppose you could call it a dive bar. Yeah, it's a classic. Can I get a Maker's on the Rocks and a Diet Coke? Thank you. This is like a classic long bar with red, are these called banquette seats? Red booths, some of which are upholstered and some of which are upholstered with duct tape, sort of like striped together to make the upholstery, basically. And it's held up pretty well. I mean, there's a reason you use duct tape to repair stuff. Some stained glass lamps hanging above the bar. It's a very cozy, nice feeling place. Their mascot is a giant pink pig. There's a statue out front of a giant pink pig, so they have some ear pulls. There's a pig on it. You can also get hot dogs here. The hot dogs are free. A shot and a beer is $5. It's a good price.
The prices compared to other bars around here were pretty unbeatable.
When did this place open?
1933. They say it was one of the first bars to get its license after Prohibition ended. I don't know how true that is, but.
Yes. What time does this place open?
8 o'clock every day except for Sunday.
Right.
Noon on Sundays. I mean, you know the Steely Dan song that has Rudy's in the first line.
Black Cow.
I did not put that together. Most of my adult life has been, my social life has been spent in bars like this one. I think the first time I came here was with a few other New Yorker cartoonists after one of the cartoon meetings. And then, yeah, that was sort of the culmination of our work week. And people would go get lunch sometimes, but, you know, a bunch of us kind of splintered off and just started coming here because drinking was more appealing than getting lunch. Like, my most treasured memories of being here are having the kind of conversations you have, like drinking and laughing and then drilling down on some emotional subject. This is where I told my New Yorker cartoonist drinking buddies that I was pregnant. We were sitting right in that booth over there, and one of them asked, like, what I was drinking. I said, I'll take a Diet Coke. And they all looked at me and they're like, you're not drinking? And I said, no. That was the beginning of my marginally more adult life. You know, I'm 40 now, and hangovers are a different animal than they used to be. It gets harder and harder to have one of those, you know, afternoons where things just unspool. I guess that's just one of those things that happens when you don't die young.
Heineken, no. Beck's, Budweiser, Michelob Ultra, Alicia, Bud Light.
It's noon, and you know, and people, you know, sometimes you're drinking in the middle of the day because that's what you do, and sometimes you're drinking in the middle of the day because you got off work at 8 in the morning, you know. And sometimes places like this are where you go when you just need to be somewhere that feels good. You know, and that can be any time of day. You just need to be around people that you can have a conversation with. You know, I mean, bars make a family, kind of, you know. And that's a feeling that I feel like only happens in, like, really older, well-established places. And I think the visible signs of age and history in a place put you in the mindset of the sort of unending stream of people and their emotions and their lives and their history. In the way that a ritual in church helps connect you to the people that did this before you, I think there's something to, you know, when your tongue is sort of loosened by alcohol and you're in this sort of like cozy place that, like, you know, you can sort of unburden yourself or be somebody's listening ear in a context where they won't have to worry about it later because you're not part of their everyday life. And I think that's important too, you know? I mean, like, it's like confession.
You, sir, have a good day.
Thanks, William.
You know, even if you go to church, church isn't going to let you sit around for 6 hours and drink. I mean, I guess it depends on what church you go to.
Cartoonist Emily Flake, hanging out at Rudy's Bar in Hell's Kitchen, Manhattan. That's it for this week. See you next week, and don't forget to follow us on Twitter. We're at New Yorker Radio.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Awe Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Rayfield, Mythali Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Emily Mann and Jessica Henderson. The Aleppo Sandwich Story was produced in collaboration with The Sporkful, with assistance from Anne Sani. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.